Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:56 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is February 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off with the Dow Gold Ratio, because it had this beautiful cyclicality to it, which has really been undermined over the last 4 or 5 years. Because we have a succession of higher highs, so each successive equity bull market on the Dow has been bigger than the last relative to gold. Then we also have the fact that there were about 35 years between the peaks, so that it would have been reasonable to anticipate that when the market bottomed in 2011, we were on the cusp of a brand new secular bull market for US stocks relative to gold, and that it wouldn't peak until 2035, and then potentially that it perhaps wouldn't even, or that it might even exceed the peak put in 2000. So obviously we've had, everything was looking fine until about 2018. And then gold broke out of its base formation and had a really impressive rally and broke the sequence of higher reaction lows. And then we had stocks outperforming for the last few years, and now gold is it does look like it's on the cusp of breaking out again. So gold is starting to outperform stocks once more. So this whole episode over the last 4 years, it really does raise awfully big questions about relying on the Dow Gold Ratio. So the first thing is it that we've had a broad stock market rally, which would have been characterized as a bull market? Or has it been more focused in the technology sector? So is it really about technology relative to gold? Because if we look at the NASDAQ and think about that in terms of the NASDAQ gold ratio, well, then what we're presented with is a slightly different chart overall. So we've had a bigger advance, but it's certainly not, it hasn't taken out the big peak in 2000, but at least it's still a reasonably consistent uptrend. So this trend could persist, and it even if it were to pull back to 6, it would still be a bull market overall. So there's the clear argument here that what we're in fact looking at is the complete outperformance of technology shares relative to almost everything else. And that is particularly true when we then think about this ratio in terms of the MSCI world relative to gold. Because obviously we also still have the peak in 1999, we have the low in 2011, but the size of the rebound has been modest, and I think that's being kind. When we think about the fact that it bottomed below 0.2 and it's currently hovering around 0.37, then a doubling relative to gold following what was a really deep pullback for gold from the low in 2011 really means that the index hasn't gone anywhere. So then it would be rather difficult to argue that we've been in a secular bull market for ex-US stocks in addition to the USA. So then of course what that also does is it helps to further emphasize the clear outperformance of technology. And this is obviously the big question of the day, because the NASDAQ is not nearly as consistent as it was. So we've had a really significant drawdown over this month. And this is a long-term monthly chart. Well, in fact, it's a quarterly chart. Let me put that up as a monthly. And we can see clearly that we've had a big drawdown followed by another decline this month. And it's really quite overextended. So obviously this is one thing about the Bloomberg, or the way that Bloomberg draws the 200 are the moving averages, is that it takes the period of the chart you're looking at. So really I prefer these 40-week and 200-week moving averages, because they represent the 1 year and 5 year average overall. So the index right now is encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. It has pulled back to break the sequence of higher reaction lows. We no longer have a sequence of ranges one above another. So this is no longer a staircase step sequence uptrend. We've had a deeper reaction. In fact, the reaction to date is rather similar in size to the pullback we saw during the pandemic in 2020, but we're still way above the 1,000-day moving average. And I think perhaps the easiest way to think about what's going on in the markets right now is an unwinding of the acceleration in asset prices that was seen during the pandemic. The world has come through the pandemic. We're now in the endemic stage. COVID's going to be with us practically indefinitely. People are either going to come up with some form of immunity, whether it is natural immunity from a prior infection, natural immunity from an infection related to a different type of coronavirus, like constantly getting the common cold, or an acquired immunity relative, like a vaccine or a series of vaccines. But as we move into the endemic stage, eventually everybody is going to come up, is either going to survive or not survive, and those that survive are going to be the ones that have got some form of immunity. And how much does the world really need additional new liquidity in that environment? Because we're past the panicky stage. Nobody's panicking any longer. The only place that is really hard on the zero COVID mandate is China. And of course, one of the problems that they have is that their vaccines don't particularly work. Certainly aren't as near as effective against the variants as they were against the original strain. So they are really over-egging it in terms of trying to keep their economy locked down. Of course, the bears of China will be looking at this and thinking, well, this must be just an example of even greater state control. And locking down China and closing it off from the rest of the world is almost identical to what Mao did. And Xi is certainly modeling his premiership on what Mao was doing. But when we go back and think about the Nasdaq, if we're going to unwind the excesses of the pandemic period, well, it would suggest that we're going to come back and test the peaks from before the pandemic. And that's around the 10,000 level for the Nasdaq. In other words, it could fall another 40% and still only be more or less approximating the 1,000-day moving average. That's obviously really quite bearish. And it's obviously also very much influenced by what happens in terms of interest rates. Now, there's a lot of commentary right now about what's going on in Ukraine. And we've had some substantial strength in oil prices, and it was off the low in here today. So we're still holding at the $90 area, and it's still reasonably well bid. And I think it is likely that at some stage we are going to test this psychological $100 area on Brent crude. But I also don't think that we've had the same kind of spike in oil prices that would accompany some really strong geopolitical risk. And of course, gold prices have also been firm this week, and breaking up to surmount the most recent of the major rally highs. So the price is a little weaker in trading on Friday, but we clearly have this rounding characteristic to the chart pattern. There's a clear succession of higher reaction lows. There were a clear succession of lower rally highs. Now it has been resolved on the upside. This looks like the beginning of a new bull market phase in gold. Now, some of it will be to do with geopolitics, but I think a lot more of it has to do with the fact that Growth is slowing, and the underperformance of the Nasdaq also signals that. It's a growth index. So if growth is slowing, well, that's not good for growth companies. Now, obviously, that's practically a truism, and it's an oversimplification of what goes on in the markets. But sometimes we can just distill simple facts down to very simple terms. And if growth is underperforming, well, then what happens in terms of government bond yields is obviously really important. So the 10-year yield has paused around the psychological 2% level. And that's not all that surprising. So we've had a really well-defined range between about 1.75 and 1.25 for most of 2021. That was resolved on the upside. We've had an impressive breakout. We're in the region of a psychological area of resistance. So there is certainly the potential that we could have some steadier action in government bonds. But then, of course, we have this other question, and it's about global growth. And when we think about consumer expectations, well, they're trending lower. So we have this Michigan consumer expectations chart, and it's clearly trending down. So consumers are still spending, but they don't anticipate that their economic conditions are going to improve anytime soon. They're looking at higher interest rates, they're looking at higher mortgage rates, they're looking at the inflation that's eating away at their wages. And even for people that have been able to negotiate higher wages, well then, inflation is eating into that too. So it's obviously a difficult environment for regular consumers, and a lot of them are getting rather less than enthused about what the potential is. And of course, we've also had a significant drawdown in Bitcoin. There are large numbers of people watch this price series, and we've had a huge amount of trading in it. I had a meeting this morning with my accountant, and one of the first questions he asked me is, how much crypto trading have you done? Because it's the number one question that's been coming up in meetings with accountants for people as we enter the tax season. Now, Bitcoin is down, testing the $40,000 level again. It had a reasonably impressive rebound off the lows from late January, and that rebound broke the sequence of lower rally highs, so it confirmed at least support of near-term significance. Now, what we will need to see is that it puts in a higher reaction low and then subsequently pushes on to new highs. And that would certainly then confirm that we're back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. But the corrective phase in the Nasdaq and the corrective phase on Bitcoin, not only are they somewhat related, and that Bitcoin tends to lead activity on the stock market, but they also contribute to consumer expectations for their financial stability, because lots of people have been doing rather well from day trading. Of course, companies like Robinhood really haven't been doing all that well, and the share IPO'd and probably got the initial investors a nice windfall when it did IPO, and since then it has lost approximately two-thirds of its value, and arguably it's still going down. Now, when we think about some of the most over-levered portions of the market, well, the ARK Innovation ETF pushed on to a new closing low in here today. So this has been a really quite profound decline, and particularly over the course of the last 8 weeks. And you've got Cathie Wood talking about the fact that many of the companies that she holds in her ETFs are trading at bargain basement levels. Well, of course, that's a matter of opinion. And but I do have some sympathy with the view that perhaps the baby is getting thrown out with the bathwater. Now, personally, I could never understand in the first place why Roku had been going up so aggressively, but I'm not all that surprised that it's lost 80% of its value so far. And we also should pay some consideration to the fact that the PE has contracted. You can't just fall 80% and the PE not contract. But it's worth reminding ourselves that the PE was at a really quite extraordinary level. So, not all that long ago, before the decline, it was north of 400. And this is for a company where they're not exactly selling something that's completely needed. And the enterprise value now has contracted meaningfully in response to that. So maybe there's a future for the company. It's probably not at a value of $500 a share, but maybe it's $150 a share, because one thing is that we've had these really profound accelerations. PayPal is still trading on a rich valuation, but it's down to about 22 and a half. The problem is the market cap's 121 million, and it's got free cash flow of about 5.4 billion. Now, that's up really quite significantly since 2019. But the problem is, of course, that it's still not an awful lot of money relative to the valuation, and the share is coming down really quickly. Now, I don't believe that PayPal is going to disappear. They do have a business. They do have billions in free cash flow. So eventually, it's going to get to a point where we're going to see the valuation improve to such an extent that it's going to become value again. Now, perhaps it's going to come back down to test the 2020 low. Maybe it might even get down to test the 2017 low. But the one thing we know is that if there are cash flows and it is a business that has got a sustainable business model, well, eventually then it will bottom. And when it bottoms, there'll be a substantial rebound. So it's certainly interesting to pay attention to these sectors right now because accelerations are trend endings. And we've had this massive reaction to rising yields. It's been the number one thing that I was worried about in 2021, that eventually we would get interest rate hikes and we would get rising yields, and it would have a significant knock-on effect for these types of companies that are very heavily exposed to rising interest rates, and they have an acute need for liquidity. So as those bond yields have risen, this is exactly what has happened. The susceptibility of these companies to higher interest rates has been graphically exposed. But perhaps even more so, it really helps to highlight just how much leverage was in the market and how levered individual investors were to rising interest rates. So obviously this is a very significant event. Now, I think it's likely that and we can also think about the fact, for example, that Block, which is the new name for Square, has got a similar pattern to PayPal, but it trades on double the valuation. But of course, and then it's not either back in the region of the 2020 low either. So a number of these fintech companies are really pulling back extremely violently. Some will eventually disappear, and some will probably bottom early. And arguably, Coinbase isn't accelerating lower, but in fact beginning to build some support. And it hasn't had nearly the same size of the pullback either. So there's certainly some differentiation going on in terms of the performance of some of the fintech companies. PagSeguro in Brazil, it's the number one digital payments company. It's Brazil's answer to WeChat. It was ideally placed when the Brazilian Central Bank announced that they were going to really promote digital payments. PagSeguro was right there and leapt on the opportunity. But the share peaked at 60. It's currently trading at 15 and change, and back in the region of the lows from early 2020. So it's a quickly growing company, and it's not exposed to the crypto sector, but much more to the health of the Brazilian consumer. And of course, Brazil, more than any other country, has been aggressively raising interest rates. And going from 2 to 10 and three quarters in the space of 12 months is a really impressive advance in government bond, or excuse me, in the Selic rate or the overnight lending rate. So that's putting pressure on these types of fintech companies. So it's falling. It's falling for reasons that are domestic. It's also falling because of the commonality with the wider fintech sector. And of course, then you have the fintech ETF, which holds all of these companies and is being sold aggressively. So that's obviously also a symptom of this contagion that we're seeing in the wider sector. The other, I think, important point, or the thing that's probably going to be explored by investors over the course of the next month, is just how likely is it that we're going to see significant additional interest rate hikes? Because if we were to see interest rates rising to 3%. So that would take the 10-year yield, I should say, up to 3%. Well, then the accelerations, and sorry, that's the 3-year. The accelerations that we've seen in the fintech sector would probably be justified. But if the 10-year yield is going to pause here around the 2% level and potentially come back to 1.75% and bob around there for a while, well, then it would probably act as a catalyst for at least some steadier action in the fintech sector overall. Then I think it's also worth considering that when we think about the battery sector and the electric car sector, we see the statistics about the number of new electric vehicles getting bought and how that's rising as a percentage of the wider sales of vehicles. But a lot of the electric car companies are trending down in no uncertain terms. So Lordstown IPO'd at 10 and it's currently at 3, and in between it got as high as 30. Rivian is also clearly trending downwards. So we're in an environment where a lot of these companies that are upstarts, and they all have their pitch decks, which are looking at a total addressable market, which is really extraordinarily large, and yet they're really not going anywhere. And then, of course, we have Tesla, which is right now in the region of its 200-day moving average, and at least steadying here in the region of the lows from late January. So we've had a really spectacular move in lithium prices. The price was up in an impressive manner in 2021. It's doubled so far in 2022. And Tesla's down from 1,200 to 860, and pausing here around the highs from early 2021 and the 200-day moving average. So it's an area where we might anticipate some support coming through. Of course, if interest rates were to push higher again from here, it would put even greater pressure on companies like Tesla. But ultimately, the fate of the lithium companies is very much tied to demand for their product from the battery companies. Of course, big ETFs like the Lithium Battery and Technology, or Lithium and Battery Technology ETF, with over 4 billion, under management is now trading below the trend mean. It's also back in the region of the peak from early 2021, so it's got a very similar chart pattern to Tesla. And I think this has to also very much factor into the swift pullbacks we've seen in some of the lithium miners this week. So Albemarle came through with stronger earnings and guidance that was not as impressive as people were anticipating, and the share pulled back $60 from the initial peak last week. So now trading back below the 200-day moving average. And Livent is just about holding on in the region of the 200-day moving average. This is the spun-off company from FMC. So just about holding on. And Allkem, which is the new name for Orocombre, is also just about holding on in the region of the 200-day moving average. Of course, lithium prices aren't going to be able to accelerate at the same pace that they have done over the first 7 weeks of this year. And ultimately, accelerations are trend endings. So this will eventually roll over. And hopefully it'll roll over because there's more supply coming to the market, and that some of these mining companies are able to ramp up their supply. And hopefully it's not because the demand for electric batteries starts to deteriorate, because that would certainly denote much slower economic growth globally. And I think this question is being answered by the strength in gold. I don't think that this is all about geopolitics. I think it's much more about the rising trend of inflation and the reality that a lot of companies are extremely interest rate sensitive, and the entire economy is interest rate sensitive, because we have this clear statistic that private assets, they only represent about 18% of all of the financial assets in the world, but its total jumped by $5.6 trillion last year. And a lot of that went into crypto and went into property. So we've had extremely large advances in asset prices. And if those asset price advances are to be sustained, well, then it's going to be very hard to raise interest rates and very hard to remove liquidity without having a really deleterious effect on pricing. So gold is obviously now starting to attract interest, because investors are, on the one hand, highlighting the fact that it's exhibiting relative strength when some of the most interest rate sensitive portions of the market are deteriorating. And if central banks are going to have a great deal of difficulty normalizing policy, and economic growth and expectations are already deteriorating before the Federal Reserve has even begun to raise rates, well, we can only imagine how slow growth is going to become when they actually do raise rates. So obviously this is a rather difficult environment for central banks, and gold tends to do well when central banks are inhibited from doing their job. So the easy way of thinking about that is negative real interest rates. Negative real interest rates alone, I don't think, are a necessary condition for gold to rally. What you need is the perception that central banks' hands are tied and that we're in a period of financial repression. And we haven't heard that financial repression nomenclature anytime recently. So I thought this is certainly a time when we can anticipate hearing more about it. And gold having broken here, broken out to new recovery highs, it's likely to then also create demand for gold shares. Because the technology sector hasn't had any competition from the global markets or from the resources sector for an awfully long time. And gold shares, because they've been forced to adopt the all-in sustaining cost metric, which is really a worst-case scenario for production, then they're managed much more conservatively by need. And the share prices are only just beginning to bounce as gold is breaking higher. Now, what this also helps to highlight is that the mining sector has a publicity problem. And they really, and it's an extractive business. And a lot of the people in the industry are shoving on in age. So they're perhaps not quite as nimble in terms of public relations as might be required in this environment. Because with the growth of ESG investing, then reorienting the mining sector to provide the metals necessary for a green revolution is absolutely vital. But it might require a lot of reorientation in terms of communication strategies from miners in order to allow them to tick the boxes necessary to prosper in an environment where there's going to be a critical demand for these metals. But gold alone trades on a really strong margin basis. So as prices rise, then it's going to create demand for the respective shares. And we're definitely seeing more interest starting to come into this sector. So the gold shares of the major miners and the junior miners are both beginning to firm in here, and at least both of these had been able to break up and out of their base formations during the last phase of this bull trend. The explorers haven't quite yet been able to break up and out of their base formation, but it's also firming and clearly now coming up to test the sequence of lower rally highs. So we're certainly in an environment here where we've had substantial drawdowns in both the speculative portion of the market and then the commodities portion of the market. And there is certainly evidence within the gold miners that demand is coming back to the fore. Now, copper prices have been ranging in the region of their all-time peak for most of the last year. And there is also a sequence of higher reaction lows within that range. So we're right in the region of the peak from back in 2011 and above the peaks from 2006 through 8. So this looks like a consolidation. And I think it is quite likely that oil prices are going to remain reasonably firm, and that copper prices are going to really substantially break on the upside. And I am stumped for the aluminium price. So that's I've never had much problem remembering tickers, but some of those LME ones do tend to stump me from time to time. Now, aluminium has broken out of its most recent range, and it's starting to push through the peaks put in 2006 and 8. Aluminium is extremely energy intensive, so the high price of oil has a knock-on effect for aluminium. Now, we can look at countries like Saudi Arabia, where they want to continue to develop their domestic alumina businesses. And now they have domestic bauxite as well, so they'll be mining that, and they want to create both upstream and downstream utilities for the production of those metals. And aluminium is one of the key ingredients in the new economy. And it's not just the new economy or renewable energy, but if we just simply think about how our own personal use of aluminium has increased over the years? Well, a lot of it is because of rising living standards. So as living standards improve, then there's likely to be continued demand growth on a per capita basis for things like copper and aluminium. And ultimately, if we're going to get to a point where the whole world is going to prosper in an environment where there's a clean, or there's a desire to have a clean environment, well, we need higher living standards. There's just no way that we're going to have an environment where people are going to be happy with accepting lower standards of living in return for a clean environment. That's just not going to fly. And we've already seen in China where they might be having the Winter Olympics right now, and you've got clean air over Beijing, and that's not a normal circumstance. And the Baltic Dry Index has pulled back aggressively, but it's beginning to find support now because the Olympics are nearly over, and China is going to start ramping up its productive capacity for industrial resources once more. China has just about all of the processing facilities for steel, coal, copper, and aluminium. And if the world is going to require more steel for every imaginable source of renewable energy, more copper for batteries and wind turbines, more aluminium for lightweight machinery, well, then China's going to be a really significant contributor to that. And ultimately, they're going to be the ones that will accept the polluting characteristics of producing those metals in service to demand from everywhere else for the metals to drive decarbonization. Because ultimately, when we think about the dream of reducing demand for oil and natural gas, well, then it means that it's substituting that oil for metal, and that those metals need to be produced. So once the metal is produced, it can be recycled. You can't recycle oil once you've burned it. And carbon credit prices have paused here around the 100 level. And they're also susceptible to higher interest rates because of the knock-on effect that it has on growth. So we're sort of in this catch-22 scenario for stock markets. If central banks ignore inflation and don't raise rates, we'll end up with asset bubbles. If central banks raise rates aggressively and withdraw liquidity, then we'll end up with asset prices that pull back extremely violently and then erode growth. But of course, the whole purpose of extraordinary monetary policy in the first place was to insulate the economy from the ravages of the pandemic and to protect growth potential. So my contention for the last year is that central banks are going to have an awful difficult time raising rates. And it's extremely likely that the yield curve spread has already peaked and that it could quite easily become inverted by the end of the year. And that would then start the clock on the next recession. And one of the reasons why stock markets remain quite firm is because investors are still willing to look through these challenges. Because they look at the fact that the yield curve has bottomed lower, or peaked lower, I should say, than any other time in the last 40 years. And they're thinking, well, if growth does experience a problem, then we're just that bit closer to additional liquidity provision. And if additional liquidity provision is inevitable, well, then there's no need to sell now, and I can just hold any cash I have and buy when the markets start to turn around. So We're still in an extremely sanguine type of attitude. People haven't been scared enough yet to liquidate positions. And usually it's that scared feeling where you get panicky sales and people are no longer convinced that they have read the market correctly. That's usually when the market bottoms. So that's also part of the reason why I think we're still in a corrective phase overall. I think that it's more likely than not that the stock market is going to remain within this corrective phase as long as there's the threat of interest rate hikes. And I think it's interesting too that the 10-year minus the 3-month hasn't really moved. So, what this is also, I think, helping to highlight is investors aren't really that convinced that interest rates are going to go up aggressively. We still have a spread of 160 basis points. And usually, it's this spread, it goes inverted before the 10-year minus the 2-year. So, what this is certainly beginning to indicate is that investors are less than convinced about interest rate hikes. And that if that's the case, then inflation is probably going to peak at some point this year. But the much bigger picture here is that when inflation does start to come down, it's probably going to bottom at a higher level overall. And that's the foundation for a new inflationary cycle. And it's exactly this kind of environment where central banks feel like they're inhibited from acting aggressively that you start to get an inflationary trend evolving. It's also why gold is in a significant bull market. But it's also likely to clearly favor companies with reliable cash flows. Now, some of the shares that are pulling back in an aggressive manner are going to survive and others will not. But then we have lots of companies where there's just no question about their ability to survive. So the Dividend Aristocrats are back in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, they're not going to be entirely insulated from deeper selling pressure on the wider markets. But the sustainability of their cash flows and the reliability of dividend increases, well, anytime they pull back, they tend to rebound quickly because value investors step in and capture and lock in the yields. Because the reason the shares are in this category is they increase their yields, or they, excuse me, they increase their dividends, which means that the better price they're bought at, the better the total return is over time. So we're certainly in an interesting environment. And then, of course, coming all the way back to the beginning of the broadcast about the question of secular bull markets. We're probably still in a secular bull market, provided central banks are inhibited from raising rates. But we're in a medium-term correction right now. And generally, medium-term corrections last for anything from 3 months to 18 months. And we're only a couple of weeks into it, really. So we could be in a volatile trading environment for quite a while. And we'll need some reordering in terms of the performance of various sectors. And I continue to pay attention to the performance of the 8 Fangman plus Tesla shares relative to the NYSE because it's breaking downwards and it was in negative territory again in here today. Now, we can certainly also see when we zoom in on this daily chart that it's super choppy. So the ratio is heavily influenced by the individual volatility that we've seen on some of these shares. And it looks different practically from one day to the next on the weekly chart because it's up one day, down the next. But the general trend since December is down. And we can look at some of the weaker components like Netflix, and it's pulled back from 700 to 400 in the space of about 2 months. So that's a really aggressive pullback. And then Nvidia was also punished this week for less than enthusiastic guidance. So the share was down again in here today and testing the region of the 200-day moving average. The continued stalwart within the sector is Apple. But Apple's also pulling back into the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, the bigger challenge, of course, is that some of these companies, like Apple, Google, Microsoft, are really well supported by strong cash flows and wide margins. Then, of course, you have the companies that don't have the same moat. And then you have Amazon. So Amazon does really well on revenue, but then not great on margins. And it's still trading on an aggressive multiple and continuing to encounter resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. So we've had a really impressive rebound, and that was a huge island reversal right at the beginning of this month, following the earnings announcements. But it's going to absolutely have to hold that $2,800 area if this is going to represent a period of support building, because the challenge is that a slowing economy for a company like Amazon hits it on the revenue side in terms of sales through its website, but then also hits it on the cloud computing side because a lot of its smaller customers run into trouble and have to downsize. So the continued underperformance of the ARK ETFs is probably going to be more of a headwind for a company like Amazon than a number of the other FAANG shares. If we are going to see an energy transition, well, certainly we can think about what happened today in the UK. I thought that this picture of the O2 Stadium, or I guess I still call it the Millennium Dome. I remember back in early 2000, or the early 2000s, living in London and thinking that a stiff wind would blow this thing away, and that's really exactly what's happened 20 years later. So, one big challenge for the global economy is a lot of the infrastructure getting built these days isn't particularly resilient. And it requires a lot of rebuilding and a lot of maintenance. And wind turbines, they don't work particularly well in very high winds and they have to get shut down. So they have an optimal level of strong winds, but not very strong winds. And solar panels need to continually be cleaned because they're usually put up in pretty dusty areas. And then they also require a great deal of cabling. So one of the challenges with distributed power is that a lot of the infrastructure isn't particularly robust and it needs to be replaced reasonably often. So it requires a lot of spending and it's very much tied to this view of economics, like the broken window, that the money will have to come from somewhere to fix the window, and then that has knock-on effects for everybody else. But if you keep having to replace the same window, it's a waste of money. You might be better off just investing in a better window. So obviously, when we think about where we are, a lot of these kinds of solutions are very interest rate sensitive. Higher interest rates demand robust solutions, and lower interest rates don't. So if we are going to move into an environment where there's going to be a lot more investment in renewable architecture and new kinds of fuel and lots of technological solutions to problems, well, higher interest rates would dictate that they be robust. A lot of the solutions that are being proposed today aren't especially robust, and it means that there's going to have to be an even bigger bull market in metals. So it's increasingly likely that we're moving more into a secular bull market for industrial resources. And if we are in fact looking at sustained climate volatility, then agriculture is likely to be the most effective hedge against it, because agricultural prices will remain in backwardation and then also continue to trend higher if supply becomes questionable. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.